The air medical accident rate. Is it a statistical blip or a legitimate trend? And what do we do about it? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest today is Don Mancuso, who is the executive director of the Association of Air Medical Services. Unfortunately, air medical services have been making a lot of news this year, and we're here to find out a little bit more about AAMS and about the industry as a whole. And it's going to be specific and timely, coming off the NTSB's recommendations that EMS safety issues be added to their most wanted list for 2009. Don, first, thanks for taking a few minutes out for our listeners today.
Well, thank you, Paul. Appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you.
Tell us to start, what is AAMS? How did it start and when? And what is its relationship to the air medical industry?
Oh, I'd love to chat with you about AAMS. I'd love to do that. AAMS is the Association of Air Medical Services. We were started in 1980. About the time the industry really started flourish in the civil aviation world. Air medical services really got their start in the Korean and Vietnam era on the military side, but the late 70s and early 80s were the start of the civil medical helicopter business. Most at the time, most of the services were hospital-owned and operated. Today, that has changed. We are about half hospital and half-based and half private. Although there's a third category of services that are government owned and operated as well. And we are we're an international trade association that represents air medical service providers, whatever their corporate type.
Now, who do you interface with as an advocate for your industry? Is it mainly regulatory agencies? Is it the healthcare industry or law enforcement, or what is your role end up consisting of?
We do a lot of work in a number of different issues, generally in three main categories: aviation and safety. Second is healthcare, and third is sort of more small business issues. So we work with legislators, we work with regulators, we work with a number of other quasi-governmental groups and other associations in all three of those areas to accomplish the goals of the community.
All right. Now, I would assume that you have to be familiar with what the NTSB said a couple of days ago about adding EMS flight safety to their 2009 wish list.
We are, yes.
I have to ask you, is the accident record we've seen so far in 2008 what the statistics industry would call a cluster, or is it a legitimate trend? Is this becoming riskier, or is it just that we're doing more of this kind of work, or what is behind these increased numbers this year?
Paul, I'll tell you, it's challenging to answer that question in a paragraph or two. Our goal is to have zero accidents. With the whole purpose of air medical services to help patient outcomes, and an accident is an antithesis to that. We have come off of a couple of years of a very low accident rate after the NTSB report, and we have to take a look at each one of the accidents and study what caused them and come up with interventions that will prevent them from happening again. We're in the process of doing that study. We are waiting for the NTSB to come out with their reports on the causative factors and trying to identify trends as we go.
Don, back in 2006, the NTSB did issue some recommendations it said it felt would improve EMS safety. Tell us a little bit about those recommendations. What was in that report?
Oh, happy to. There were, four different recommendations. First one had to do with having all legs of an air medical transport flight fall under what's called Part 135 regulations. The second one had to do with requiring air ambulance service providers, particularly helicopter air ambulance service providers, to institute risk management assessment tools to help the pilot in making the go or no-go decision. The third one had to do with flight dispatch protocols and support, and the last one had to do with implementation of what's called TAWS, or Terrain Avoidance Warning Systems. Each one of those initiatives were discussed and promoted by the NTSB as potential interventions to that, because they would have had a positive safety effect on one of the accidents that happened in the time frame that they studied in that report. And we've been working with the FAA and legislators on Capitol Hill, as a matter of fact, to try and find an easy and efficient way to implement those recommendations. For instance, a number of those initiatives, we've worked with the FAA on, rather than waiting to go through the multi-year regulatory process, to help them develop advisory circulars, notices, and other kinds of changes to the regulations affecting air ambulances, so that safety enhancements could be implemented in a shorter time frame.
All right, we need to take a break here. When we come back, let me run down that list of four things you mentioned there, and let's discuss them one by one.
Okay.
Don Mancuso is the Executive Director of the Association of Air Medical Services. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways. And you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and known ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here talking with Don Mancuso, who is Executive Director of the Association of Air Medical Services. We're talking about flight safety and EMS operations. And Don, before the break, you mentioned four different areas in which the NTSB had issued recommendations it felt would make your industry safer. Let's run these down one by one and just discuss them briefly. The Part 135 requirement for all legs of an air medical operation, if I recall correctly, that stemmed from the fact that some of these accidents seemed to be happening during times when aircraft were just being shuttled from one place to another, or on the way to pick up someone, or returning home at the end of the day. Am I reading that correctly? And is Part 135 requirements really a cost-effective way to improve the safety during those phases of flight?
The reason the NTSB recommended Part 135 flight on all legs has to do with weather reporting requirements. And there's a challenge for us in that when many of the places we fly to in the air ambulance business, we're not going airport to airport. We're going to either a hospital heliport or destination at a scene accident and the like. There often aren't weather reporting stations at those locations. So many times, in order to use the IFR system, our members will fly Part 91 to get to the destination they're going to. And what we've been working with the FAA on is to find a workaround so that we can fly Part 135 using higher weather minimum and still gain access to the IFR infrastructure, and hopefully maintain a higher level of safety when we fly.
If I hear you correctly, the answer that would be best for AAMS and its members is probably envisioned being something that's not a regulatory requirement, but something that's more along the lines of an advisory circular or something that's not quite so hard and fast?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. What we're trying to do is make the regulations work in a way that doesn't actually decrease safety as opposed to increasing safety. If you were just to require air ambulance services to fly Part 135 all the time without making other changes, as I've tried to outline, what would happen is a lot of our members would no longer be able to use IFR. So we're trying to encourage instrument flight rule flight as opposed to only VFR flight. And so what I'm saying is we're taking a look very seriously at the NTSB recommendation and trying to find a way to meet the spirit of it and still maintain the higher level of safety.
Okay. Let's talk about risk management when it comes to making a go, no-go decision. Mm-hmm. I have to kind of chuckle when I even see that mentioned in relation to your industry, because risk assessment is a little more multifaceted when you're an air ambulance pilot or crew, because if risks are high for the flight and you decide not to make that flight, the risks for the person you'd be serving are infinitely greater. I mean, it's kind of endemic to your industry that people who are going to get on a helicopter are going to try to push it if they at all can possibly make it, because they know that if they don't go, someone else takes more risk.
Paul, that's actually a common misperception. The standard of operation in our community is that when a flight request comes in, the pilot is asked, was just told that there's a flight request and to where. And the pilot's responsibility at that moment is to take a look at the weather, take a look at the condition of the aircraft, make a determination based on aviation safety criteria whether or not to accept the flight request. A pilot is not told what the patient's condition is, and there's a reason for that. We need to make sure that it is safe enough to conduct this flight in order to do it on behalf of the patients as well as the medical crew on board that aircraft. So it's the risk that the general public believes the pilot is under, which is the pressure to fly because of the condition of the patient. That pilot, much is done to keep that pilot unaware of that patient's condition until after the decision to fly has been made.
That's interesting. I had not known that. I guess at some point it doesn't become a matter of whether you send an ambulance or not. It becomes whether you send one by air or by ground.
That's true. And, a lot depends on where this flight request is coming from. About 60% of our flight requests are coming from emergency rooms or ICUs. They're physicians in hospitals that have a patient that needs to get moved either for reasons of higher level medical care. They may need to go to a cardiac center, they may need to go to a stroke center, what have you, or they may need just to go to a facility that has a particular hospital or piece of medical equipment, cath lab or what have you. So for 60% of the flights, it's not a first responder calling for us. The other 30% are usually scene flights, 30 to 40% are scene flights. And there you've got first responders and sometimes ground ambulance providers calling and saying, this patient really should be flown.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for busting that misconception. If we do that, that's a part of our goal too. I think we all know what role terrain awareness equipment would play in this scenario. But what are we talking about when we talk about dispatch protocols? What is proposed to be changed there?
Well, initially the NTSB was asking for changes to dispatch procedures to make our dispatching services more like the traditional dispatching services you find for Part 121 carriers, full dispatch control, air traffic control, those kinds of things. And unfortunately, many of those criteria can't be used in our facilities because of the kinds of flying we're doing, that we're off airport, we're to unimproved landing destinations, and those kinds of things. That said, the FAA has been working with a group called the National Association of Air Medical Communication Specialists on their certification program and training materials to enhance some of the training opportunities for the folks that work in our what we call communication centers. In addition to that, the FAA released some changes to operation specifications to require air ambulance operators to demonstrate that they maintain operational control at all times during flight, and have recommended that air ambulance operators develop what's called an operation control center. So, again, through notices and op specs and some regulatory changes that are not full rules, we've worked with the FAA to endeavor to comply with what the spirit of the NTSB recommendation was.
Let me ask you one final question, and this has to do, I think, primarily with some of the requirements that are imposed on pilots by what you call scene work. Although obviously any operation from a hospital heliport would have this factor too. This is an industry which, from what I can gather from everybody who I talk to about it, requires a high level of experience and proficiency of its pilots. And as a result, a lot of these positions are only open to people with 1,000 or 1,500 hours or more experience as pilots. Does this make what everybody in the industry points to as a looming long-term pilot shortage a more acute issue among helicopter operators and specifically among EMS?
You know, it's going to be very difficult to assess. Many of the pilots in our industry are from the Vietnam era or subsequent wars, whether that's
Desert Storm
and out of Iraq. So we have a number of younger pilots looking to get into the industry, but they're going to need the hours that our members are used to having, you know, as part of their recruitment process. And as you mentioned, it's usually 1,000 to 1,500 hours. If we're not able to continue to find pilots at that level of experience, it's going to mean a change in our training programs, and that's already been looked at.
Is that more a matter of actual proficiency, or is it a matter of a threshold for an insurance requirement?
No, it's really a proficiency issue. The type of flying is unique in the aviation world, and we have always asked to have the best and the brightest in doing this kind of work, and so in order to keep our standards high, we're going to have to bolster our educational program. There's been a lot of effort in the last couple of years on simulation training and resources available in that arena. There's the FAA worked with us to put out a resource guide on what's called AMRAM, or Air Medical Resource Management, based off of the crew resource management keystones. So there's a lot of work done in that arena as well.
If there is additional training required after the recruitment process for pilots in the future, how will that cost be picked up? I mean, I know the same problem faces the airlines to some extent, and we may eventually see that reflected in our ticket prices and so forth. But, you know, in my area, Life Flight is not a bottomless well of money. I mean,
yeah, it's very challenging. We have a very unique reimbursement system for our line of business. We get paid off of a fee schedule with Medicare that doesn't change no matter how much equipment you have on board or how many hours you have to spend training your employees or what have you. So it's a fixed reimbursement rate. And so it's always a challenge. And many of our other payers, private insurers, state Medicaid programs are doing the same thing. So it becomes challenging to find newer and less expensive ways to do some things. Obviously, increasing costs haven't been helpful either. Shortages of nurses and pilots have raised salaries. Fuel costs have been an issue. Insurance has been an issue in the years past. So, all of those things are constantly being monitored and can cause some pressure.
Well, Don, in closing, tell us how people can find out more about the Association of Air Medical Services, and is there anything else you would want to leave our listeners with that we haven't talked about?
We would welcome anyone interested in the field to take a look at our webpage. It's www.aams.org, and you'll find on there some information about the industry in general, FAQ, and some information about the association is involved with.
Well, Don, thanks very much again for your time. We appreciate the work you're doing, and best of luck tackling these challenges.
Well, thanks, Paul. I appreciate the opportunity to share what's been going on.
Don Mancuso is Executive Director of the Association of Air Medical Services. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.